Guacamole. It's a Chris and Rob late night talk show. They call me Chris.
I'm Rob.
And we're here bringing you another scintillating edition of the Chris and Rob late night talk show on WAIF.
Cincinnati. Right out of the chute, good gosh almighty, we have world famous author James Loewen. His book came out, what, last year, 2 years ago?
A while back. It's called Lies My Teacher Told Me. Now, Rob, did your high school history teacher ever lie to you?
No, not that I know of. Pretty much everything he told me was the truth, unless you consider it lying when you only give someone half the information, in which case, yeah, I guess a lot of lies were told. But
that would be a white lie then, right?
I don't know, however you want to say it. They're not giving you the full picture, so is that a lie or is that not a lie? And high school kids, my gosh, they got to go through so much material. Do you have time to talk about, do you have time to spend 10 weeks on the Wobblies in eighth grade? Who knows?
Well, between biology, chemistry, literature, reading a little bit of Shakespeare and history class, it's hard to take it all in when you're at that tender young age, 16 or 17, especially when you're blossoming all at the same time and learning how to drive.
Well, now you got to give kids classes on computers, you got to give kids classes on sex education and drug and alcohol education. Is there really time to teach kids the three R's plus the one H?
And also, as you know, tomorrow is the day of Thanksgiving. The day after tomorrow is Thanksgiving Day. And we're all going to be sitting around the table with our respective families, eating turkey and sucking on stuffing and cranberry sauce. And what are we celebrating anyway? Are we really giving thanks? Is your family really going to say grace before dinner?
I'll be very thankful if there's no celery in the stuffing.
Or are we really celebrating genocide? We'll get to all this and much more with our guest, James Loewen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Good evening, Mr. Loewen.
Hi.
How's it going?
I'm doing fine. I just finished my new book, literally today.
What's your new book called?
Well, it's going to be called Lies Across America, What Our Historic Markers and Monuments Get Wrong. And so I have at least one. I've been going across the United States talking about the ideas in Lies My Teacher Told Me, and as I do, I also read every historic marker I can get my hands on. In fact, usually I read every historic marker in the whole state, and I look at lots of the historic monuments.
Well, you know, whenever I travel around with my dad, and I try to do as little of it as possible these days, he always stops. If we're driving on the highway or on some old road, some old route somewhere.
That's just what happened on our family vacations. Dad thought it was good for us, and I'm trying to argue, well, it might have been bad for us.
Well, maybe. Let's talk for a minute about the first Thanksgiving, because most school kids, most teenagers read or hear about the first Thanksgiving when they're in school. It's a very famous story that a lot of American tradition and patriotism is built upon. According to the American tradition, which is a commonly used textbook, the American tradition says, after some exploring, the pilgrims chose the land around Plymouth Harbor for their settlement. Unfortunately, they had arrived in December and were not prepared for the New England winter. However, they were aided by friendly Indians who gave them food and showed them how to grow corn. When warm weather came, the colonists planted, fished, hunted, and prepared themselves for the next winter. After harvesting their first crop, they and their Indian friends celebrated the first Thanksgiving. Mr. Loewen, what's wrong with this picture?
Well, you know, in a way, nothing. That is to say, everything that that book said did happen. What the interesting phenomenon, though, is what it leaves out in that case. And what all of the books but one that I read, and I must say I'm the only living American ever to have read cover to cover 12 high school American history textbooks and live to tell the tale. And what all but one of them leave out is the plague. And I've asked hundreds of my students, my first year students at the University of Vermont where I used to teach, did you ever hear about the plague? And they all say, what plague? The Black Plague, meaning, of course, the plague that happened 2 centuries earlier in Europe. And I say, no. And the plague that they leave out is the plague that swept through southern New England, in fact, all of New England probably, 2 to 3 years before the pilgrims got there.
I never heard about this plague.
Exactly.
Well, tell us a little bit about it, Mr. Loewen.
Well, it was so severe. In fact, I make a comparison to the Black Plague or the Black Death. The Black Plague killed one-third of the population of Europe over a three-year period. And that was enough to disorient the rest and to cause great numbers of people to turn to alcoholism or to turn to fanatical Christianity or other religious sects. Some people stopped growing crops thinking that the second coming of the Lord was at hand and so on. And that was killing one-third in 3 years. The plague we're talking about in about 1617 in southern New England killed between 90 and 96% of all the people who lived there.
That would be the Native Americans,
exactly,
not the colonists.
The people who lived there were American Indians. And the plague was probably given them by a bunch of British fishermen who had been fishing off of Massachusetts for decades before the Pilgrims ever arrived on the scene. And they would put into shore in Massachusetts for fresh water, for firewood, and sometimes to steal a few Indians and sell them into slavery in Europe. And on one of these occasions, they probably gave the plague, and we're not sure what it was. I actually tend to think it was bubonic plague, because the Indians differentiated between it and the next plague they got, which was smallpox. So it wasn't probably smallpox, but we're not sure what it was. But anyway, they probably gave the plague to some Indians they met, who then gave it to other people. But we don't know for sure, because there also were pandemic plagues that came sweeping through all of North America from the Spanish down in Florida, or even from people making contact in Mexico. So for one reason or another, this plague tools through New England 3 years before the Pilgrims get there, and it wipes out the Indians. I mean, when you kill 90 to 96% of the people, the folks who survive can't even bury the folks who were dead. All they can really do is flee to the next village, and of course, when they do that, like as not, one of them is carrying the disease, and they bring the disease with them.
So what did the Pilgrims do with all the bodies?
Well, the Pilgrims actually saw all these bodies on a trip they made to Rhode Island to treat with Massasoit, who is quite famous as kind of a Tonto figure who helped the Indians. Well, helped the Pilgrims. Massasoit was happy to have the Pilgrims move into where they moved into, which they renamed Plymouth, because he needed allies, because his own forces were so reduced by this illness that he was afraid of the next tribe to the west. And so the Pilgrims moved into a town with freshly cleared cornfields and with a cleared out spring, and it was called the town of Patuxet. And the town of Patuxet has exactly one survivor who wasn't there. And that's why he survived. He was in England. He had been enslaved by previous British fishermen, taken to Spain, actually, sold into slavery, escaped slavery in Spain, made his way to England. He actually makes a total of 6 trips across the Atlantic, and finally he gets put back into Massachusetts just before the Pilgrims get there. He walks to his home village only to make the unbelievable discovery that every person there is a corpse. And then the Pilgrims come on that scene, so he throws in his lot with them, and his name is Squanto. Ever hear of Squanto?
Yeah, Squanto's in all the history books.
Yeah, we all hear of Squanto, and that he helped the Indians, the Pilgrims, by showing them how to put fish heads in with the corn, and the corn grew tall, and the rest is all Thanksgiving. So the textbooks actually give us Squanto's name, which is not important, and give us the little story I just told you, which is not very important, but what they leave out is what is important, which is this plague. And this is so important that it explains why the Pilgrims didn't have any real race relations problems with the Indians for the first 25 years they lived there, because the Indians had been so wiped out.
Well, it almost sounds like that movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, where the guy wakes up one morning and everyone's gone because some comet came and took all the people up with him. Now this guy's walking from restaurant to restaurant and taking anybody's car that he wants.
Yeah.
So the
Pilgrims,
you know,
it's actually even more like the science fiction movie and the science fiction radio show and the famous science fiction novel, War of the Worlds, because it turns out that this same type of plague afflicted American Indians wherever they were, because they did not have immunities to the diseases coming from Europe and Africa, and they also killed off all the people, not all, but similarly 90 to 95% of the Hawaiians, of the Australian Aborigines, and the people throughout the Pacific. And so H.G. Wells actually wrote War of the Worlds as an allegory to the, you know, we've got these Martians landing. You remember the whole story.
Right.
And they're far more technologically advanced. They're so technologically advanced that the silly arms of the Earthlings can't do anything against them. Well, that's exactly the case as the Arawaks in the Caribbean, when Columbus comes back on his second voyage, his voyage in 1493, which is the really significant voyage. What he did in 1492 was perfectly nice, but it was nothing that Leif Erikson and the Viking folks hadn't done in the year 1003. Well, what's different about Columbus is, in 1493, he comes back with 17 ships, with 1,000 to 2,000 soldiers, with attack dogs, with cavalry, with cannons, and he proceeds to take over the island of Haiti and rename it Hispaniola, and that's a conquering of somebody on one side of the Atlantic by a nation state on the other side. That had never been done by the Norse. So that's different. Well, that's the model, and then what similarly happened in Hawaii and in even Australia is the model for War of the Worlds, and H.G. Wells meant it that way, but there's one key difference. In War of the Worlds, you may remember, the invaders get the attack from some kind of single-celled organism or something, you know, from some germ. But in the reality of the Western Hemisphere and then the Pacific, it's the natives that are attacked by the disease brought by the conquerors.
So the Europeans are like have the best of both worlds, yeah. The best of the Martian world,
do it on purpose.
And the best of the Earthling world.
The Pilgrims, however, gave thanks for the disease that hit the Indians.
Well, they were a bunch of religious fanatics anyway. They probably thought God did it on purpose to bless
exactly
them.
That's exactly what they said. In fact, in one case, one of them writes, they had a dispute with the Indians a little north of Plymouth, or Patuxet, after they renamed it. It was Plymouth. It was up at Saugat, and the Indians said, wait a minute, we didn't give you this place. We're still living here. And then they got smallpox. And Bradford writes in his journal, so as God hath thereby cleared our title to this place, so he makes God the original real estate agent, clearing the title by giving the Indian smallpox. So that's exactly what they thought.
So what's wrong with setting aside a day once a year to give thanks for everything that we got?
Well, I'm going to do it on Thanksgiving. My sister's coming down. Other relatives are coming. I think that's just fine to celebrate, you know, family togetherness. But the problem is that as a nation, every year the President of the United States issues a Thanksgiving proclamation. And I have read these proclamations from Carter through Reagan through Bush to Clinton, and they're almost always the same. There's probably a Thanksgiving speechwriter who never even gets fired, you know, from one administration to the next. And they all basically give thanks that God is on our side. That is, if you're giving thanks to God for our blessings as a nation, and of course we are far and away the most popular in some ways and certainly the most powerful nation on the earth, that is implying, in fact it's really directly stating, that we owe our blessings because God is on our side. And I don't think that's exactly the same perspective as, say, somebody from Ghana or Great Britain or Japan, you know, about the United States. So I think it leads us to become ethnocentric. And I think the United
what
States
also
is already
leads you,
ethnocentric enough.
It lets
I don't
you get reelected. James, it lets you get reelected.
What?
It lets you get reelected. If Clinton didn't go up there and talk about God and country this Thanksgiving, the Republicans would go crazy on him talking about how he's a godless liberal.
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't, and there's no way that he's going to use something as small as the Thanksgiving proclamation to give the Republicans a club to beat him to death with. It's just not going to happen.
Sure, I understand that. I just think it makes us stupid. The things we don't know about Thanksgiving are amazing. I mean, for instance, Thanksgiving was really started in 1863. It does not go back to 1620 and the Pilgrims. You can look at antecedents. I mean, there were times when George Washington declared Thanksgiving, not generally in the fall. There were times when people before the Pilgrims declared Thanksgiving, including the Spanish who were here way before the English were, and including the American Indians. But our Thanksgiving dates back to 1863. And, of course, in 1863, Lincoln is going to emphasize the Pilgrims because the other people who really founded the United States earlier were the British in Virginia. But Virginia's in revolt, you know. Virginia has seceded. So he's not going to emphasize them. But the result is I've asked hundreds and hundreds of students, and not just in New England, but also in Chicago and other places, this question. I've asked them, when was the country we now know as the United States first settled? And I really originally thought that people would say, well, 13,000 years ago or 30,000 years ago or whatever they believe for the first coming of people. But they don't. The consensus answer is 1620. And, of course, 1620, though it's the date of the Pilgrims, not only leaves out the Indians, It also leaves out the Spanish, and then it leaves out the British themselves. If you have to be British and speak English in order for that to count as settling, well, how about the British in Virginia? So instead of thinking of any of those things, there's kind of a blur in students' mind between 1492 and then 1620. And so the pilgrims are the settlers of America. Well, that's just bad history, and it, as I say, it makes us ethnocentric.
Well, that's when what we now know started.
No, it isn't. What we now know started a lot more from Virginia than it did from the little bitty pilgrim colony.
Jamestown was here, what was it, 10 or 20 years before?
1607. And the reason I say it, I mean, actually, if you look into it, Plymouth was the smallest of the colonies. It soon got absorbed by Massachusetts, which was a separate colony, you know, started in 1630 by the Puritans, who were a very different group. And although, I mean, what we can say about the pilgrims is that they were nicer than the folks in Virginia. I mean, the folks in Virginia were a bunch of bumblers. And one of the things they did is they, when they first got here, they knew the Spanish had found gold in the Americas, and so they were going to find gold. And so they dug holes aimlessly in the tidewater flatlands of Virginia, where there's no gold, and they forgot to plant crops, and therefore when November set in, they were hungry. And do you know what they ate?
This ought to be good.
It's
not
very,
each other, I hope.
One did, or actually one, more than one. One woman got eaten after she died. Well, we hope it was after she died. But they also disinterred the bodies of recently deceased Indians and ate them.
Yeah.
And the Indians were shocked, and I mean, this is sacrilegious. And I have to say, it would mess up Thanksgiving dinner if you think about it.
You're actually saying that the European settlers were more savage than the Native American savages.
That's certainly what the Indians thought.
Yeah.
And another way they thought that is, you know, the Native Americans certainly fought battles. In fact, they actually enjoyed warfare in certain ways. But their battles were much lower scale than they were after the Europeans got here. And again, this happens. The pilgrims show us the way here. The pilgrims, who first started getting called pilgrims, incidentally, in the 1880s, not in the 1620s. But when the pilgrims tool in 1620, pretty soon they get together with some Indian allies, and they attack the Pequots in 1637, I believe it was, in Mystic, Connecticut. And the Pequots virtually get wiped out by them because they attack the village of the Pequots when the men are elsewhere. And the men of fighting age, and they attack it in a pre-dawn rage attack, and the Indian allies are shocked at what happens because they kill them all. They even burn the village down and burn up many of them and kill some 500 or 600 of the 670 or 700 people there. And the Indian allies say, no, don't do that. They wanted to make slaves, essentially, or tributary anyway, of the Pequots, but instead the Pequots just got wiped out. So that's an example of the savagery of warfare that the Europeans brought. And it's not exactly, I'm not trying to badmouth Europeans there, it's just the kind of warfare they were used to, because they were used to nation states, they were used to guns, they were used to cannons, and it's just warfare on a far greater scale than the Native Americans were used to.
This is the Chris and Rob Show on WAIF. If you'd like to call into the program and talk to Chris and Rob or our guest, who's James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, the phone number is 961-8900.
So we're not supposed to feel bad that the English settlers were more efficient at warfare?
No. My book is not an exercise in guilt. And actually, there's a lot of idealism in my book, and I don't think that very many readers end up feeling bad because they have read it, or end up feeling angry with me because they've read it. And in fact, I'm not anti-hero. I do try to show the dirty underside of some of the heroes that we have celebrated, and I'm trying to do that in my new book about the landscape. But I'm trying to resurrect some other heroes that people don't even know about, never even heard about. For example, in Massachusetts, there's the town of Amherst with Amherst College and UMass Amherst, and I'm sure you've heard of Amherst.
Basketball team.
Yes.
Yeah, they're super.
They are. Well, it turns out, of course, that Amherst was named after Lord Jeffrey Amherst, whose main claim to fame, and the reason he gets everything named after him, is because he's the first proponent, possibly in the history of the world, and certainly in the Americans, who actually used germ warfare. He deliberately had his subordinate give some Indians in Pennsylvania smallpox-laden blankets.
Now,
and, of course, that...
Let me interrupt for a minute, James. When the original settlers came over, we were talking earlier in tonight's program about the plagues that swept through the early Native American cities,
right,
and so forth. But the Europeans didn't do that on purpose. They just unwittingly came over on boats.
Amherst is doing this some years later. He's actually doing this in 1760 or so. And by then, we do know, I don't know that we have a germ theory of disease exactly, but we do know that smallpox is contagious and that you can get it from other people's blankets, and we do know that Native Americans don't have any defenses against it.
Well, that's even more despicable.
What?
That's even more despicable.
Yeah, well, it was pretty despicable. He definitely did it on purpose. Now, as a result, he gets all these things named after him, and I point out that right there in the same town of Amherst, there was a lovely woman named Helen Hunt Jackson, who nobody's ever heard of, hardly. And she grew up in Amherst. She then wrote books because she was so moved by the nasty ways that the United States had treated Indians. And her first book, which came out in about 1870 or so, was called A Century of Dishonor. And so you can hear in the title that she wasn't totally excited about how we had treated the Indians. And she actually paid out of her own money to have a copy given to every member of Congress, in a desperate attempt to change American policy. And by gosh, the Grant administration, which wasn't by no means as bad as everybody, you know, Grant is just remembered now as corrupt or something, or maybe he wasn't, but his administration was. But Grant did some very interesting things, and one of the things he did was he appointed her commissioner to some Indian groups in Southern California. Says, okay, you know how to do this, you do it better. And so she went over there, and by gosh, she learned a lot of stuff there, and put it into a novel called Ramona, which was a bestseller in the late 19th century, and it was kind of a novel trying to do for Indians what Uncle Tom's Cabin had done for slavery, namely move people to realize we were not treating the Indians right, because she realized her nonfiction book hadn't really made the impact that she had hoped. Well, then she dies. And so I went in, of course, this is my problem, I try to tilt at windmills, but I went into the Lord Jeffrey Amherst bookstore on Main Street in Amherst, and I said to the clerk, well, you know who your bookstore is named after? And they said, oh, yeah, we know the smallpox germ warfare man. And so I got the name from them of the owners, and I submitted to them a nice letter saying, you know, you guys could rename your bookstore after Helen Hunt Jackson, who's right from Amherst. I mean, Lord Jeffrey Amherst never set foot in the town. And somebody who even had something to do with books. And, of course, they wrote me back and told me what I could do with my idea. So, anyway, I am trying to preserve some heroes, but not necessarily the same one.
Hold on, you're out trying to get bookstores named after them. Why are you preserving heroes?
Huh?
Why don't you go to Borders and tell them what to name their bookstore?
That's an idea. I don't have any real problem with Borders, though. I mean, you know, with the name of it.
Who is Miles Standish, and are there any other heroes from the original Thanksgiving?
Well, the whole group of pilgrims, the original Thanksgiving did actually happen. It happened in November or so, maybe October, of 1621. And the pilgrims and the Indians got together for 3 days. They each showed each other their games, and they each kind of showed off their warfare. I mean, Miles Standish had the pilgrims drill and fire guns, and that impressed the Indians, and the Indians also showed them some things with bows and arrows and stuff, and they did this for 3 days and had a good time. So I have no problem with that. And furthermore, we have to admit that we can go proudly state that the pilgrims paid the Indians for the land deals they or negotiated with them for the land deals they took on the whole. Unfortunately, though, then pretty soon the land hunger of the Europeans starts taking over, and we get the Pequot War that I just mentioned, and we get the taking of more and more and more land. And finally, we end up with the tremendous King Philip's War in 1675. And this is another time that I badmouth what the textbooks are doing, because if you read the textbooks, most of them leave out King Philip's War entirely. And so I've asked a lot of college students, name the major wars in American history. And they usually come up with about seven, including, you know, the Spanish-American War and the War of 1812. Of course, they come up with World War I and World War II and so on. Well, it turns out the King Philip's War, which almost nobody has ever heard of and nobody lists, killed more Americans, absolutely, that is in actual numbers, than the War of 1812 or than the Spanish-American War or even than the American Revolution. And you can imagine what a tremendous percentage of the people it killed, because, you know, in 1675 there weren't very many people. It was a very significant conflict, and it ended up in the virtual extermination of all the Indians in Rhode Island and Massachusetts, and yet nobody's ever heard of it. Well, this is the kind of amnesia that we end up with. I don't think that's a good thing.
James Loewen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, ragging mostly on history teachers and history textbooks that you may have been exposed to in high school or college. What's the bottom line? What's your message in this and the new book you're writing and your attempt to correct history?
Well, I think the reason I'm doing it is because I think that the way we learn history helps make us stupid. And I think I was stupid after my high school history course. In fact, sometimes I think my book could be called, as a subtitle, Revenge Against Coach DeMolin, because I had a coach for history, as all too many people do, who didn't have any interest in history, just tried to teach something so he could be the basketball coach. And I think we end up stupid, particularly in the area of race relations, which we've kind of focused on tonight, but in many other areas as well. And by stupid, I mean we don't really understand what happened and what causes what in American history. And therefore, we can't apply history to the issue of race relations today. And of course, in the last few years, we've had all kinds of issues of race relations, from Rodney King to and the riots there, and the riots in Chattanooga and St. Petersburg, and to the O.J. trial and so on, affirmative action issues. So it's a big live issue today, but we can't seem to think about it historically. And if you can't apply history to race relations being about the most historically embedded problem there is, well, then it's a pretty worthless course. And I would argue that the way it's usually taught by teachers who stick to the book, it is a useless course. It's a waste of time, and we need to teach differently. And I have to say, my book has sold a lot. I mean, it's over a quarter million at this point.
Wow.
And a lot of that has been sold to high school teachers who get past the title and realize they do want to teach differently, and my book helps them get some leverage on how to do that. So I really think there is some hope, not in the textbook industry maybe, but in the teaching industry.
Thursday night when you sit down with the family around the dinner table to practice a little bit of gluttony and feast on a turkey or whatever it is that your family has, are you going to be celebrating family relationships and your thanks for everything that you have in the world, or will you be celebrating the American history of genocide? That's a loaded question.
I hope that I'm only going to be celebrating the former, and I really hope that everyone else listens to this. And actually, my book's selling well enough, I don't have to put in a plug for it, so just go down to the library and check it out. They do have it. And read the Thanksgiving chapter, that's chapter 3, before or during the Thanksgiving holiday, and I think it'll add something to the fun of the holiday.
Okay, thanks. James Loewen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Okay.